Today's show is brought to you by Hulu Plus. With Hulu Plus, you get total control to watch thousands of shows wherever and whenever you want. SGU listeners can get an extended 2-week trial of Hulu Plus by going to HuluPlus.com/SGU.
You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 25th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, ladies and gents.
Hello, hello.
How is everyone?
Hello. Not bad. Hey, happy birthday to Thomas Crapper.
Oh, no shit.
Well, okay, it's
and there's
not
the first one. Okay.
Really his birthday, but nobody really knows when his birthday was. But it is the day when he was baptized, September 28th, 1836. So, you know what?
Close
We're just
going
to go with that for National Crapper Day. International. Let's make it International Crapper Day.
Now, what didn't he invent?
Thomas Crapper is best known for inventing the flush toilet, which he didn't.
Yeah. Right.
But a lot of people think so, probably, you know, because they think of the name and it just seems natural. And,
Thomas?
You know, and it's a bit immature.
It's a good
but
story.
He did not invent the flush toilet. He actually invented the ball cock.
Right.
So let's all just relax.
Wait a second.
Too easy.
Like, he didn't invent the toilet, but his real last name was Crapper.
His real last name is Crapper, and he's actually, I think the reason why people think he invented the toilet is because he owned a very large plumbing business, and he was one of the biggest promoters of the flush toilet, and he was highly successful at installing flush toilets, including at Westminster Abbey, for instance. And he also did have several patents on things related to the flush toilet, such as the ball cock, which I did not realize was an actual term that is used for the little floaty ball thing in your toilet tank that tells the toilet to stop filling up.
Yeah.
Which I love. The first time.
The name or the thing?
I love the thing. I love the mechanism. I love that we still use that. It's so simple and beautiful. Like, I remember the first time I had to, you know, when I was in my own apartment, like, I never had to do this at home with my family. So I'm like 17 and on my own, and there's a running toilet, and I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. And I pulled off the top of the toilet tank and I looked inside and I'm like, oh, I get this. And I was able to fix it because it's a
because it was obvious.
Nice.
Yeah.
In this age of iPhones and, you know, glue instead of screws, it's rare that we come across a common everyday appliance that you can actually open up and look inside and see how it works. But the flush toilet is still one.
It stood the test of time, right?
Yeah, except for those fancy Japanese toilets that they have at Google headquarters. Remember those with the heated toilet seats and it like talks to you and stuff? Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, the ones that wiped your ass for you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You guys didn't really get to experience those because you're men and you would have had to go poo, but I love them. But Thomas Crapper invented the ball cock. And, he was a very successful plumber. And happy birthday to him.
We celebrate him today.
And the word crap.
Yeah. Because we do, like, sometimes call it the crapper in our crasser moments. And so some people think that the word crap as a euphemism for the word shit comes from Thomas Crapper. But the word crap actually predates Thomas Crapper by quite a long time. It's Middle English, apparently. The best guess is that it comes from several different words like Old French, crap meaning siftings, or rejected matter, or and the Dutch krappen, which I love to pluck off, cut off, or separate.
Release the krappen.
So he was just this guy was born to augment the toilet and to sell them.
Yeah, I think that this might be a case of that phenomena where people tend to gravitate towards things that their last names suggest.
Right.
I think Richard Wiseman talks about this in one of his books on human psychology. He was born to revolutionize the way we crap.
Thank you.
Hey guys, while we're talking about birthdays, I want to wish my dad today. We're recording on the 25th, and today is his birthday. So happy birthday, Joe Novella Sr.
Yep, yeah. 83.
All right. Way to be prolific there, Joe.
Novella patriarch.
So, Jay, tell us about GMO food. What's up with that? Is it safe? Is it not safe? Should I eat it? Should I worry? Tell me.
GMOs have been in the news quite a bit. You know, we're hearing a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of people really, really scared of them and worrying about the future and, you know, what's the intent of the government and these big evil corporations. But for those of you who don't know what they are, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. And these include things like bacteria, yeast, insects, plant, fish, mammals. This all started in 1972. And in order to create a GMO, the scientists, you know, started mutating genes, or they use existing genes and then they insert them into other organisms. And they could also remove genes as well in the whole GMO process. And this is an attempt to cause a change in the organism. So, you know, you would be taking aspects of one organism and putting them into another, and a very simple explanation of them. A real world example would be like we would change wheat somehow to make it more resistant to dramatic temperature change, or to be resistant to certain insects. A plant could be made to have more nutritional value or have a longer shelf life. You know, there's lots of different things that they experiment with. But the question that we're going to explore today is, why is there such a distrust in GMOs, and in particular, the GMO foods that we're eating?
Because it ain't natural.
That's right. But there's an interesting twist to this information that I'll tell you about in a moment here that I was shocked when I read it. So a July Gallup poll found that 48% of respondents believe that GM foods, quote unquote, pose a serious health hazard. Now, how can that be when the consensus in the scientific community is, as stated by the American Association of the Advancement of Science, consuming foods containing ingredients derived from GM crops is no riskier than consuming the same foods containing ingredients from crops, plants modified by conventional plant improvement techniques? And they continue, no adverse health effects attributed to genetic engineering have been documented in the human population. So other large health organizations from other governments have made similar statements. And of course, the conspiracy theorists can state that GMOs are a multi-government plot for mind control, addiction, or whatever else they come up with. If you trust the scientific process, then you'll believe that the 20 years of safety studies confirms that GMOs are safe.
Yeah, let me talk about one study a little bit, Jay, because there was a recently published 2013 systematic review of 20 years, as Jay's saying, of research, and into a specific question into the composition of GMO foods, the end result, the corn kernel, you know, with the stuff that you would eat. And essentially they show that there's no difference. You can't find that. Not only are they safe, they're no different than non-GMO food.
Well, but Steve, even stranger, and this was the thing I was alluding to before, that they were saying that statistically they're even safer than selectively bred modified foods.
Right.
Which I found to be, I was totally shocked. I couldn't believe it.
So let me just read the conclusion to this review. It is concluded that suspect unintended compositional effects that could be caused by genetic modification have not materialized on the basis of this substantial literature. Hence, compositional equivalence studies uniquely required for GM crops may no longer be justified on the basis of scientific uncertainty. So not only is there no evidence for it, they're saying there is sufficient evidence that we don't have to worry about this anymore.
So why all the hate going on for GMOs? What's the problem? What did these companies do to produce that kind of distrust? Why are they believed to be so unsafe? And why is there an intense outcry against them in the first place? And even more interestingly is, what's it going to take to prove to the general public that these products are safe? Monsanto has a big bad corporate reputation similar to the evil pharmaceutical company conspiracy theorists like to believe, who have their hands in everything and a desire to control people. You know, I think it's a combination of things. One, that these big companies don't do much to promote themselves. You know, many of us love McDonald's because they really do have awesome French fries, but mostly because McDonald's spent millions, maybe at this point, it could even be into billions of dollars of advertising, you know, so we know what a Big Mac attack is. And that's just marketing genius. And it takes a lot of money to make, you know, a company as big, and McDonald's is a huge company, right? You know, why aren't they thought to be evil?
They definitely are, by the way, thought to be evil. Not are evil. I mean, thought to be evil.
Yeah. All right. You know, Rebecca, funny. I guess you're right. Yeah. I actually have read some funny things.
It's like
about
the Super Size Me type of rat. Yeah. They get. But Jay, I can't imagine what kind of commercial Monsanto could do that wouldn't seem manipulative.
You know, at this point, yeah. If they started in the 70s, like McDonald's did, you know, and had a happy clown.
There are some industries where it's just hard. Can you imagine a happy clown promoting Monsanto? I don't know. I just think it's counterproductive almost because it just seems like it would come off as insincere and as if they're trying. It just doesn't match.
So and I think it would because they actually are an evil company.
Like, well, I don't know really about that, are. Rebecca. I think they have a bad rap. I think they're just another company and they've just been targeted.
I think saying just another company doesn't really help them though. That's damning with faint praise, if anything.
Yeah. I mean, corporate America is pretty dark in my opinion.
Yeah. They're like any pharmaceutical company, for instance. They're just like any other company. They are after a dollar at any cost. And the problem is that the item that they're selling happens to be something that is extraordinarily important to a lot of people. So in the case of pharmaceutical companies, it's healthcare. In the case of Monsanto, it's food and, you know, in a lot of cases, livelihood for instance, farmers, especially in developing nations and things like that. So when you have companies that pursue the dollar above all else, you run into problems. If the thing they're foregoing is other people's health and safety. And I think that's the problem people have with Monsanto that aren't based on bad science.
Yeah, I'm not even convinced, though, of just the generic anti-Monsanto claims that are being made, because often I think it's just politics. I'm not defending them or saying that they don't do the things that corporations typically do. I agree. Again, like pharmaceutical industries, I think a perfect analogy. They're constantly doing this like slightly squirrely thing to try to skirt the regulations and to try to maximize their sales, et cetera. And they absolutely need to be regulated for that reason. But I don't think that they're doing anything that's overtly evil. I think they're just, you know, they're just trying to make a buck in the capitalist system that exists.
See, I guess the only argument I'm trying to make is that I'm not trying to make an argument for any kind of absolute evil. I'm just saying that merely by the product they're selling, the fact that they're doing these things like skirting the rules and trying to make a buck by defying certain regulations, does cause demonstrable harm to some people, more so than a company that is just selling widgets.
I agree, but at the same time, I wouldn't demonize the companies, and I think that's what happens. I think, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they do squirrely things, but they're also demonized. I think Monsanto has been so unbelievably demonized that I, you know, wouldn't believe at face value any accusation against them. I think the truth is probably a more complicated story than the one that you're reading, you know, online or by critics.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely stick to what a lot of the agricultural scientists are writing about it because their criticisms tend to be very good and based in the science. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Overall, I think GMOs, they have an inherent creepy factor to them that the average person doesn't read enough about or really understand to get over that baseline fear. I mean, it is creepy if you think about it, like what they're doing. They're manipulating the genes of all sorts of different
Personally, right? I find it exciting and interesting. I don't find it creepy, but I guess it depends on if you're
I do too, Steve. The two of those things are, you know, simultaneously going on in my mind. Like I'm thrilled by it, but I also like really want to trust the people who are doing it, and I want to know that they have good business practices and a lot of, you know, oversight. Like I don't want it to just be one crazy guy in a mad doctor's laboratory giggling to himself. You want to think that there is a lot of process and workflow involved to keep it safe and keep it above board.
No, absolutely. We need total transparency. We need careful oversight and regulation of any, you know, health related or critical industry like this. Absolutely. I don't like characterizing it as evil, to be honest with you, because I think it's just motivated reasoning. I think that they will make a lawyer's case for themselves in their own position, and they're the good guys in their own narrative, just like everyone in the world. So it's more about not letting them, you know, create this narrative where they can get away with doing things that maybe the rest of us think are not legitimate or not fair or safe or whatever.
So my question to you is, did Darth Vader think he was evil, or was he actually doing something good?
Very good question.
That is a good question.
What Jay is saying is that pharmaceutical reps are basically Darth Vader, and I would agree with that.
I don't know, Jay. I wonder how he could rationalize away killing all those little Jedi kids.
Well, because they were going to grow up to be Jedi adults.
That's true.
Because his Sith Lord Jedi told the master told
you,
him
would you
what
kill
to do?
Baby Hitler?
I don't know. The acting was so bad; it was hard to take it seriously.
Directing left too much to be desired.
All right. Well, speaking of anger, Evan, why are people on the internet so angry all the time?
Oh God!
Because they're people, maybe. I don't know. Just a guess here.
They're humans.
They are humans. They're people. USAtoday.com ran an article recently titled, "Anger is the Internet's Most Powerful Emotion." And my first thought when reading that title was, duh, because I think an argument can be made that anger is the most powerful emotion, either in the internet age, pre-internet, and likely the post-internet age.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
The internet.
But what do they mean by powerful? What do they mean, the strongest or the most prevalent? Do they just mean the loudest? What are they getting at here? So in order to find out, we have to travel around the world in our ship of the imagination.
Really?
All the way to China.
Oh my God. Is this a child's podcast? Like, is it a multicolored ship?
That's a Carl Sagan riff.
Evan, I'm there already.
Yep. Bob's good.
Bob's in the ship with you at the console. Like, let's go, Evan.
And why are we going to China to talk about this? Because the paper that they are citing comes from Beihang University, and the paper focuses on the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, which is called Weibo, Weibo.
Wait, that's their Twitter?
That's their Twitter.
It's like a combination of Twitter and Facebook. It's
yes,
super
right.
popular.
It's Twitbook.
Yeah, I guess so. It's kind of an all-in-one catch for the Chinese
Facer.
Population. They have 500 million users compared to about 200 million for Twitter.
Yeah, so but they got about 1.5 billion people, so, you know.
Yeah, I suppose per capita, that's probably roughly the same. Back in 2010, researchers from Beihang University studied 70 million Weibo tweets over a six-month period. Now, they used emoticons as their guide, and the researchers separated the tweets into four categories: anger, joy, sadness, and disgust. The team looked into how tweets containing certain emotions spread from one user to the next. For example, if user A sent out a sad tweet, the team would look to see if any connected users would respond with a sad tweet of their own, and to see how far that spread would go. Now, of all the four categories, it turns out that rage or anger was the emotion most likely to spread across social media. And it poses this ripple effect that could spark irate posts up to 3 degrees of separation from the original message. And the spread of anger was particularly high when the rage originated from a user with a large follower base. So the more followers, the angrier the initial anger became. The researchers said, and here's a quote, "Our results show that anger is more influential than other emotions like joy, which indicate that the angry tweets can spread quickly and broadly in the network, while out of our expectation, the correlation of sadness is low."
Well, that certainly conforms to anecdotal experience.
I wonder how much is influenced by what sort of things people choose to share. For instance, if when people talk about things that make them happy, they tend to share personal things. But when they talk about things that make them angry, they're talking about general society sort of things. And so the latter would be more likely to be shared.
Spread. Yeah, that's a good point, Rebecca. I like it.
I agree. Yeah, the angrier you are with something, the more passionate you probably are about it and wanting to express that to as many, to more people. And given that, well, the internet gives you a certain cloak, and a protection from the usual interpersonal communication of face-to-face conversations. I don't know, people tend to be, you know, as we have experienced, quite bold in their opinions when they're expressed over the internet.
I wonder if there's also just like a basic human psychological component to that, in that in a community, it's important to spread warnings about danger. And so we have an instinct, if you will, to spread negativity, because it's almost like we're trying to warn our community about something. Whereas if you're expressing something that's happy or joyful, you know, you share that with people that you're intimate with, but it's not like you really feel the compulsion to keep spreading it throughout the community.
Steve, that makes sense, but I'm sure you'd agree that that's probably just one of the many variables that
yeah,
play into that.
Of course. Yeah, with this sort of thing, even if the effect is real and it's not an artifact of how the data was collected and analyzed, which it certainly could be, then the number of possible, you know, stories you can weave about how to explain it, you know, are numerous, and they're not mutually exclusive. As Rebecca said, it could be something, just a marker for some other phenomena, like personal versus public, or it could have something to do with attention, or it could be passion, as Evan said, or could be an instinct to warn. I mean, there's all kinds of factors that could be brought to bear. And there's certainly nothing in this study that separates those out.
Do you guys think these sorts of, well, for lack of a better term, outbursts on the internet could have an effect on how other people interpret the news stories that they're reading?
Oh, sure.
Well, yeah, I think absolutely, Evan. I mean, you read what somebody tweeted and they're pissed, and you get a little pissed. And then you go and you research and you look up that article, and you have all these preconceived notions before you even start reading the first word, and you know how that can impact what your takeaway is. You know, your expectations can totally bias, you know, how you're going to walk away from reading something like that. So yeah, absolutely.
And perhaps that's why Popular Science just recently announced that they are shutting off their comments feature for their online articles.
Whoa.
Because they feel that it can be bad for science, that these sorts of things, these comments that people read, are contaminating the scientific information contained within the actual articles themselves. And it's influencing people's decisions when they go ahead and do things like, you know, vote for politicians or, you know, voice their opinions on matters which have to do with public policy and these sorts of things, that they say it has a direct impact on how science is going to advance.
Well, it's not them saying
it. In this country
it.
And around the world.
You know, we talked about the study that I think they reference, actually.
They do, yeah.
Which shows pretty convincingly that people are grossly affected by the comments they read on science news articles. So I think it's cool that they took some research that was well done and convincing, and they have used it in their website design. It'll be interesting to see if it has an effect.
Do you think critics will say that they're kind of abandoning the field in a sense?
No, they're eliminating the field. So I agree with that decision. I think it's interesting. And it is, as we're learning, you know, the social effects of the internet and social media and how it's being used, I think we do have to make course corrections. What I find on a site that is as public and as mainstream as Popular Science, where you could literally have thousands of comments on an individual article, I find absolutely no utility in those comments except to utterly lose faith in humanity. It doesn't add anything. You can't have a conversation. It's just a vomiting of negativity and paranoia and conspiracy theories by the lowest dregs of society. And then maybe some people desperately trying to add some reason mixed in there. But I just don't see any purpose to it. It does distract from the crafting and the message and the information in the article. I think if you have a blog with a community where it's actually, you get a conversation going and it's more carefully managed, that's fine. That's different. But like, you know, I read mainstream articles and there's 1,000 comments. What's the point of throwing your comment into that? And whenever I read them, it's like, I feel like I'm punishing myself reading those comments.
I can't get through 2 or 3 of them. I stop because I can't take it.
Yeah, the problem is mainstream news attempting to catch up or what they see as catching up to social media and blogs. They don't want to be left behind. So they started instituting comment systems. And it was, yeah, as everyone soon discovered, it was the wrong decision. The comments are great on blogs, like that are well moderated, and disastrous on mainstream news.
I agree.
Yeah, Bobby, guys, yeah, I do agree. And my knee-jerk reaction to hearing this for the first time is that, yeah, that's probably a good idea, especially if they're basing that on some research. But part of me will miss comments sometimes, because when I'm doing research on news items, often I will look to the comments to find an interesting angle that I hadn't considered or an interesting point that the author missed. And at least, I guess, some of the sites that I frequent, that happens fairly often. So I would miss that in my research.
Yeah, but I agree, Bob. But those are sites that are frequented by like science aficionados, and where like there might be 20 or 30 comments to the article, and it's clearly well managed. Yes, but when it's a site where there's hundreds or thousands of comments, and it just by random people, not a community. I think it's.
Well, Rebecca,
yeah, every
said
site
it.
Has to decide for itself.
Rebecca said it useful. Needs to be moderated, and if the volume is too great and to be moderated, then you have to
then turn it off.
Well, or you could just put much heavier restrictions on it. I mean, what else can you do?
And YouTube is actually finally starting to clean up their act, and they're announced that they're going to start instituting better tools for people to help moderate the comments. So maybe someday in the not too distant future, the YouTube comments section will no longer be the basement of the internet.
And Popular Science made a good point in their article about this. They wrote, "Even a fractious minority wields enough power to skew a reader's perception of a story." Actually, it is like the tyranny of the minority, of those people who are vociferous and angry and fractious. Yeah, it's like, freedom of speech and expression and communication and community is not necessarily best served by having a completely open forum where the loudest cranks command all the attention. The medium needs to be moderated and managed to the point where, you know, where there's a constructive discussion. And sometimes that might mean, you know, giving people who are softer a place to speak, and also putting the reins on people who would otherwise completely dominate the conversation.
Well, I think one of the answers, like we said, is people are more jerky on the internet.
Yeah.
They're anonymous.
Yeah, that's the social distance.
But it's not just people who are anonymous, Bob. The social distance, there's a lot of people who I know who they are, and they're just, they're bigger assholes online or over email than they are in person.
They have
it's
internet
called
balls.
Internet balls. Thank you.
Yeah. It's Lord of the Flies. The internet is basically a big virtual Lord of the Flies. All right.
Piggy.
Let's go on. Rebecca. Shouldn't we be warning people about potential side effects?
No. We should give it
up. Andrew Robinson, side effects.
Should give it up completely. Let them suffer on their own and figure it out. There's a new paper out. The Association for Psychological Science has announced that apparently listing the potential side effects of a product can ironically increase its sales if enough time passes between the time that a person reads the warning and the time that they actually acquire the product. Uh-huh. So I hear you saying, what? Thank you, Bob.
Yes. You're welcome. Rebecca says, what?
So it was a collaboration of researchers from Tel Aviv University, NYU, and also psychological scientists at a business school in Singapore called INSED, which, little known fact, my very good friend went to, and I went to visit her in Singapore because of it. So I'm totally in favor of those guys. But she had nothing to do with this study. I just wanted to mention it. So what they did was they showed subjects an ad for cigarettes. All of the subjects were smokers. Half of them saw an ad for cigarettes that included a warning that smoking causes lung cancer and heart disease and emphysema. And the other half of them did not see any such warning. What they found was that if the participants had the chance to get the cigarettes immediately after viewing the ad, they purchased fewer cigarettes if they had seen the warning, as you might expect. But if they had to wait a few weeks to get the cigarettes, the researchers found that the people who saw the warning were actually more likely to buy more cigarettes. They found the same sort of results using They found the same results using an ad for artificial sweeteners.
Sweet.
So what the psychologists think is happening is that the people who see the warning are internalizing this idea that the company is more trustworthy because they're being open about the things that are wrong with their product. While the people who are seeing the ad that doesn't include any warnings, they're seeing the companies as being more untrustworthy because these companies are lying to them. They're purposefully concealing the side effects. You know, this is just one study. It was on quite a few subjects. I think there were like several hundred subjects, I think, were studied in this. So, and the results were significant. So it is very compelling. But at the same time, I think we have to remember that there's a huge body of research showing that, for instance, when it comes to cigarette smoking, there is a demonstrable decrease in the amount of cigarette packets being purchased in places where they start putting graphic warnings on the packages, which again, you know, that might be because people are seeing it immediately and deciding to give up. There's no length of time between seeing the warning and getting their cigarettes. Maybe that's why.
And they have to be visually graphic, though. The evidence really is only it's only convincing for the visually graphic disclaimers or warnings.
I do see this new study being touted online and blogs and on forums as like, oh, well, I guess we shouldn't worry about these warnings on cigarette packets. No, I don't think that this is applicable to that situation. What this is talking about is when there's that gap between people seeing the warning and having the product. I think it's most applicable to like drug commercials where, you know, you have the monotone voice at the end of the commercial as the woman is, you know, spinning around in the field of flowers. The voice is saying, you know, make some stomach cancer. Yeah. Right. So, you know, people are seeing that commercial. They have a long time between seeing it and then going to visit their doctor and asking for it.
It is consistent with the overall, I think, pattern in psychological research that shows that if you want to statistically affect the behavior of large numbers of people, you have to emotionally manipulate them, not reason with them.
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys hear there's been another major breakthrough in carbon nanotube technology?
You know, I almost don't even read that anymore. It's just like so many. You hear something cool and then you never hear about it again, just like so many other of these apparent advances. So I didn't even read it. I just read the title. I'm like, oh, that's cool. More nanotubes.
Well, come on, now that you brought it up, what do we got?
Yeah, but I do peruse them and just to see, all right, is this something real and interesting or is it just another incremental thing I don't have to worry about? So this is interesting though when I read the full article. So as we've discussed on the show before, carbon nanotubes are made of carbon in a specific arrangement. It's very strong, conductive. Like they're like superconducting and they could be used to make electronics among other things. Until just recently, no one's ever actually built a computer out of one. The hope is that carbon nanotube technology will be the successor of silicon in terms of making transistors and computer chips. But there's been major hurdles to manufacturing enough carbon nanotubes that are of sufficient quality to actually make them into processors. When trying to mass produce carbon nanotubes.
Oh, consistent shape?
Yeah, so they can get to like 99.5% pure, but it's not good enough. That last 0.5% is a problem if you're trying to build computer chips because that they'll be error laden, you know. So, there's two specific kinds of problems. One is that occasionally, you know, while most nanotubes are straight, occasionally a nanotube will have a kink in it. That's a problem.
Is that a Peroni tube?
Jake.
But wait, when you say a kink, like, what is this, a manufacturing defect? Like, what does this?
Well, it's self-organization, right? It's self-organization. That, you know, they're not making each one, so that's just,
it has a little bend in it, yeah. The other thing, and this is interesting, Bob, I don't know if you knew about this before, but so most carbon nanotubes will function like semiconductors, which makes them very useful for electronics, but occasionally a carbon nanotube will be arranged in such a way that it behaves like a conducting wire. These are called metallic carbon nanotubes. Whoa. That's also a problem because, you know, they can't be switched on or off like semiconductors. They just will conduct. So these the engineers found out how to get rid of all of the metallic carbon nanotubes. What they do is they turn off all of the semiconducting nanotubes, and then they hit it with a lot of electricity, which essentially vaporizes all of the metallic carbon nanotubes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
What about the Peroni nanotubes?
So for them, they didn't come up with a way to get rid of them, but they came up with a design for a transistor that is immune to the effects of these imperfections. They call it an imperfection immune design. So they just figured out how to put it together so it doesn't matter if the occasional tube has a kink in it. With these two techniques, they constructed 178 transistors and built a basic computer out of carbon nanotubes.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Should have read this.
Yeah. The first time anyone's ever actually built a computer out of carbon nanotubes. It's, obviously not the kind of thing that you're going to run Windows on, but this was a proof of concept that they were able to do it, to be able to accomplish it. They ran basic math algorithms on the chips, and they worked. They actually functioned as a computer.
So, cool. Did they say anything about this being a precursor to like a quick, obvious next step? Or
this is two main hurdles to get over in terms of actually building transistors out of carbon nanotubes. So, and this should be perfectly scalable. They were using their university's manufacturing facility, not industrial fabrication process. But there's no reason why that if they just transfer the process over to an industrial fabrication facility that they shouldn't be able to mass produce carbon nanotube transistors. The article also says that computers based upon carbon nanotubes rather than silicon will have an order of magnitude greater energy efficiency.
Hmm.
It'll use 10 times or whatever less energy than, in which we're starting to get to the limits of silicon. One of those limits is just energy dissipation. Just
oh my
dissipation.
God. The supercomputers, they're designing the next generation of supercomputers, and they're like, it's going to take the energy of a city, almost to run this damn thing. It's a huge, huge concern. So an order of magnitude improvement on that. I know it's quite a leap to go from 170 something transistors to a supercomputer, but that's a great advantage.
So yeah, this seems to be chugging along. I think that carbon nanotubes are going to eventually reap all the promise, all the hype that we've been hearing about it.
It
takes time.
In our lifetime.
I think so.
I think so.
The hype is always there 10, 20 years before the reality, but just like we were reading about smartphones in the 1980s, now we finally have them.
And room temperature superconductors. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, and jetpacks and all those other cool things, flying cars. No, seriously, some technologies manifest, some don't. I think this one seems like one that will. I mean, just keeps chugging along. As you say, Bob, like we read about these breakthroughs all the time. That this is there's a steady incremental progress.
Yeah,
it's actually moving towards very specific manifestations.
Yeah, it's so easy to get jaded, though.
Yeah, I know. Right.
Same with like new solar cell improvement. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, no. That's every day almost.
New battery storage technology.
Well, I am curious how long it's going to take before there's a computer sitting on my desk that actually has a carbon nanotube processor, whatever, RAM transistor in it or whatever.
Yep. Who the hell knows,
Right. Hey, don't forget that you could become a member of the SGU and support our skeptical activities and help us change the world. In addition, for being a premium level member or higher, you get access to all of our premium content, extra bits that we record every week, and you get access to ad-free versions of the SGU. So go to our homepage, check out the membership page, take the time to give some support back to the SGU. Let's move on. Evan, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Yeah, so we got to get caught up in a few weeks of noisy here. I'm going to play last week's for you first, and then we're going to jump back to the prior week after that. But let's take care of last week's business first. I will replay for you last week's Who's That Noisy.
It is a great honor for me to take part in this motion picture tribute to my boyhood hero, Dr. Robert Goddard, and to discuss his contributions to science.
Okay, Dr. Robert Goddard, contribution to science, boyhood hero, that's none other than... Here's a name we could all love and envy. Werner Magnus Maximilian Freiherr von Braun.
Werner von Braun. No way.
Werner von Braun.
Freiherr von Smith, right? It's like, what?
I love it. I love it. And of course, was a German, later naturalized American rocket scientist, aerospace engineer, space architect, one of the leading figures in the development of rocket technology, both in Nazi Germany in World War II and afterwards in the United States. He is considered the father of rocket science.
And a Nazi. Right?
No one's perfect. Right?
Hey, you know, he went to the home team, and
I didn't mean to bring everybody down. I'm sorry.
Let's not bicker and argue about who's a Nazi,
about who developed what, or who made the V2 rocket that was going to carry the atomic weapon to destroy us all. But no, he's chief architect of the Saturn V launch vehicle that propelled the Apollo spacecraft to the moon.
This is Saturn V.
So, you know, that's not insignificant.
Not insignificant. Yeah. Nice double negative.
I love double negatives.
I don't not love them. Yeah.
I don't not love double negatives. Plenty of correct, guesses from listeners. Ben Fortell, your name was chosen. You are the winner this week. Congratulations. Jumping back a couple weeks, we had a little contest going in which we asked people to submit to us their favorite science or skeptic quotes from the movies, music lyrics or television show quotes or pretty much anything that you could find in the medium. And I think you guys will remember this one.
Not a bear in sight. The bear patrol must be working like a charm.
That's specious reasoning, Dad.
Thank you, honey.
By your logic, I could claim that this rock keeps tigers away.
Oh, how does it work?
It doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
It's just a stupid rock.
Uh-huh.
But I don't see any tigers around here, do you?
Lisa, I want to buy your rock.
Awesome.
Classic.
The classic from The Simpsons, the bear
patrol. That was Homer. That was Homer. Am I right?
Yes, very good, Bob.
Great job, Bob.
Yes, and Lisa Simpson. Going over about how logical reasoning works, or in this case, doesn't work. So a classic, definitely. Levi submitted that to us, and that's going to win for the best television one. Now, for movies, so many suggestions. But I'm just going to read to you one quote from the movie Contact, which, you know, we're all quite fond of, being Carl Sagan's great work and turned into a wonderful movie directed by Robert Zemeckis back in 1997, in which the main character, Ellie Arroway, says, "You know, there are 400 billion stars out there just in our galaxy alone. If only one out of a million of those had planets, and just out of a million of those had life, and just out of a million of those had intelligent life, there would be literally millions of civilizations out there." Sheila Simon, thank you for submitting that one. And your name is also going to go into the drawing. So,
do you have a new one for this week?
I do have a new one for this week. Another classic noisy. It's not a voice. It's a rather peculiar noise. But let's see if you can identify this. Here we go.
Wow.
That's weird. There's lots of little noises in there I thought I recognized.
Some sort of stuff is happening.
Think about it. See what you can find maybe online. And I think you'll be fascinated next week when we reveal it. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email address for submitting answers for Who's That Noisy. And as I said before, our forums are sguforums.com. Feel free to post your answer there. Good luck, everyone.
Guys, it's time once again to take a quick break from our show to talk about this week's sponsor, Hulu Plus.
Okay, so a couple nights ago, I was over Steve's house, and I look in the other room, and his youngest daughter is watching the Doctor Who reboot that started in 2005. And we were talking about it, and I actually got hooked on the show by watching it over my shoulder for about an hour. So I started watching, and I love it. So that's my recommendation.
Doctor Who.
You got it.
And you know, Hulu Plus actually has exclusive content. There's some Hulu originals, including The Awesomes, which is starring SNL's Seth Meyers, and Moon Boy, starring Chris O'Dowd from The Bridesmaids. I have to check those out.
All in HD quality.
That's right. It's all streamed in HD quality, and you can get a 2-week free trial by going to HuluPlus.com/SGU or click the link on the SGU website.
You can see Hulu Plus on just about any of your devices. Amazon Kindle Fire, Apple iPod, Windows 8 Nook, Nintendo 3DS. If it's a system, it'll get Hulu Plus.
All right. So just go to HuluPlus.com/SGU to get your 2-week free trial. All right, guys, let's go back to our show. Joining us now is Jamie Williams. Jamie, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me on.
And Jamie, you are the executive director of Bad Science Watch, which is a Canadian organization that, well, I guess, watches bad science.
Correct. We're a consumer protection organization and science advocacy organization. We are looking to get stronger consumer protection regulation against products and services sold with bad science or advertised with bad science, and to get current consumer protection regulation properly enforced.
How's that going?
Well, we're relatively new, and we only have a couple of projects under our belt, but our most recent one, the Stop Nose Herds campaign, did manage to, while not achieve everything we were going for, we have had a small victory in that we've managed to get the new guidelines for no-sode licensing to include a new contraindication, so that there is now a warning message that says this product is not intended as an alternative to vaccination.
Yeah, we talked about no-sodes a couple of weeks ago, but why don't you give us a brief summary of what they are for our audience?
So no-sodes are homeopathic preparations made from animal or human tissue, mostly. There are some exceptions, but generally it's animal or human tissue that can be blood, cerebrospinal fluid, pus, discharges, skin scrapings, all that wonderful stuff. And it's prepared in the standard homeopathic fashion, diluting it and succussing it until it's practically gone. And then, among other uses, they are used as homeopathic vaccines or vaccine alternatives. That's the most widely described use that you'll find in the popular media. And if you look for homeopathic vaccines on Google, you will be finding information about no-sodes.
Right. So they have no legitimate use, no evidence that they work, no science to suggest that they might work. They're magical potions, basically.
Exactly. The same as with every other homeopathic product of sufficient dilution. There's nothing in it. You're just buying sugar pills or drops of water or alcohol.
So, yeah, I think it's the no-sodes, specifically homeopathic products in general, are a good target for consumer protection, for skeptical outreach, public education, because they are 100% demonstrable nonsense. There's actually no gray zone here whatsoever. There's no wiggle room. They can't possibly work. They are literally nothing. So I think it's a good idea, you know, the Stop No-Zodes campaign. So how do you feel about Health Canada's reaction to this whole topic?
Well, it's been a little bit confusing, actually. Of course, we are very happy that they've taken this one small step to address the problem. We're happy that they've actually recognized that there is a problem and been willing to concede that. But, of course, as you discussed in your Neurologica blog post the other day, they have somewhat missed the point. It's not realistic for us to expect a complete reversal of their policies, because homeopathy actually has quite a comfy position in the regulation here. It's got a very established history, and unlike some places where there's just no regulation, here you actually apply for a license for a homeopathic product and get a homeopathic drug identification number, which Health Canada says is their mark of safety, efficacy, and high quality. That is where the contradiction comes into it. They're approving something which has absolutely nothing in it for no specific purpose, but saying it's safe and effective.
Yeah, there's an unavoidable conflict there. And I think it's, you know, you do have Health Canada on the run a little bit. My advice would be this is not the time to back off at all.
Yeah, absolutely not. This isn't our, we're not treating this as a time to sit back and congratulate ourselves and then find something else to do. We really want to take this step that they've taken and build on it. If they're willing to concede that there is a problem, now there are other avenues that we're looking into, such as the Marketed Health Products Directorate, which oversees what sort of claims you can make for them and the enforcement of those claims by, you know, for example, practitioners, manufacturers, and distributors. So that's one of the places we're looking to continue this line of the campaign.
But I think what's interesting here is that you have Health Canada caught in a self-contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
They, on the one hand, they say that their process is one that assures safety and efficacy. On the other hand, they're saying the intended use of this product that we approved is efficacious. It doesn't work for that. Don't use it that way.
Exactly. Use on the direction of a healthcare provider who is more than likely unlicensed, unregulated, and uneducated.
Yeah.
But still, yes, safe and effective, except for vaccines. But if the practitioner tells you to do it, you're exactly right. It's a conflict.
But and there's nothing to keep a homeopath from giving a nosode as a vaccination.
It's all over the internet. There's a very prominent homeopath right here where I am in Vancouver, who has the homeopathic vaccines available all year round, but then around the flu season, she tends to push it quite heavily. So, and we have a naturopath from the US, Kate Birch, who is giving seminars to homeopaths across Canada and, you know, independently accrediting them as homeoprophylaxis supervisors. So it's pretty widespread in Canada. Of course, it's impossible to ever get some hard numbers, but it's simply the presence and the continued advertising of it as a valid alternative, which is delivered alongside misinformation about vaccines, that's a problem for everybody.
So part of my concern is the literature on disclaimers and warning labels, the bottom line is that they don't work. Maybe there's some effectiveness, you know, in the very short term for the most graphic warning labels about direct harm, that sort of thing. This sort of disclaimer, there's no evidence that it has any effect whatsoever. In fact, it may have the opposite effect by making it seem like everything's on the up and up, making it seem legitimate because you're being honest about whatever. This is, and if anything, counterproductive. It's only useful, in my opinion, as a way of shining a bright light on the absolute failure and hypocrisy of Health Canada. And they have to, you know, I would suggest taking a tact of embarrassing them into going further, or at least, you know, you have to, I think nothing short of drumming up public support for the notion that this is a fraud is going to, you know, create the political will to change the laws so that homeopathy is not approved, you know, as efficacious and safe.
Well, you make some valid points, and you're exactly right that they have they've tied themselves a noose on this topic, and of course we're going to run with that. But we're looking at this change in the context of what before we decided to make this concerted effort and engage in Health Canada's stakeholder consultations for these licensing guidelines. Before we decided to get into that, it was dominated by pharmaceutical companies, by paid industry lobbyists, by AstroTurf campaigns, and by professional representative bodies like the College of Naturopaths or what have you. And I think when you take a look at this change in the context of that and them having their own way and the Natural Health Products Directorate being staffed by just a combination of bureaucrats, naturopaths, TCM practitioners, industry stakeholders, I see it in that context as much more significant. It's just one of what we are planning on having many achievements, which will, in aggregate, we're hoping to achieve some significant level of change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not trying to in any way downplay your victory. You got them to make a very important admission. In terms of the net effect, it's a stepping stone to other goals. It's in and of itself, it's not going to achieve anything, but it by getting them to admit, we're approving this product that you shouldn't use as it's used and intended. That's a great chip now to have on your side. But the question
exactly.
is, what are you going to be able to do with it? And I think your bigger point is correct that unfortunately, and this goes, beyond the notion of alternative medicine, in general, industry interests in whatever are consistently there to lobby the government to get their way. And consumer protection organizations, are much smaller, much less funded, or not able to address all the issues that are on their plate. And so it's kind of a losing battle, where industry self-interest, they're there day in, day out, because they have the financial interest to continuously lobby for their position.
It's a wide range of well-funded and well-motivated opponents that we're up against. But when my fellow co-founders of Bad Science Watch came together and decided to do this, it wasn't because we thought it was going to be easy. It wasn't because we thought, this is a good way to kill some time. It's because we can't just sit back while there's, while there's kids dying of vaccine-preventable diseases in a first-world country like Canada.
That's the root of activism.
I think alternative medicine is probably one of the worst issues because the people who should care just don't seem to care. Professionals, scientists, it requires a certain specialized knowledge in what's actually going on in the alternative medicine world to realize how completely fraudulent bullshit it is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that actually brings up an important point is we found it actually quite difficult to get the people who, as you say, should care, who, granted they may not have the time, knowledge, or inclination to do something themselves, but to do so much as write a letter or bring the issue to their professional organization or college or what have you, even getting them to do that have proved rather difficult in our campaign. We were backed by, and we're very grateful for the public support of the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health and the BC Centre for Disease Control. And they supported us publicly on their website. On our Stop NoSodes website. stopnosodes.org. But we were in contact with another health authority, which did send a letter for us, but declined to be associated with us publicly. And the vast majority of associations and organizations that we contacted simply didn't return our emails and phone calls, which is very disappointing. But in the end, we did manage to get almost 600 medical professionals, academics, and scientists to sign our open letter to Health Canada calling for the delicensing of NoSode products.
When you recognize the state recognizes as a profession a group of people who are not based upon science or reality, then this is the mischief that flows from that. And then those are the people that regulate themselves, that regulate their own practices and products, because they're now state-recognized experts. like naturopaths, homeopaths, chiropractors, acupuncturists, etc. So that's the problem with licensing unscientific professionals like that.
Exactly.
One of the many problems. Now, so you're kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm. Another thing which has happened since the Natural Health Product Directorate was formed is the consistent lobbying in the absence of any opposition of these same industry groups and lobbyists and, you know, AstroTurf campaigns that I mentioned before. And they had some valid grievances at first. Things were taking an undue amount of time to process, but the NHPD was dealing with a backlog of many, many tens of thousands of applications. But the way they went about speeding up that process, making it more efficient, was cutting out so much of the evidence checks. They granted people exemption numbers after cursory reviews of their applications. The initial regulations, which in many areas were quite decent, have completely lost their teeth because the industry found out they didn't like it once they had to act under regulations and rules. They didn't like the system that they advocated setting up, so they lobbied against it.
Yeah, they couldn't, that's really sad. I mean, when you think about it, they couldn't handle their own heat they turned on.
Yeah, Jamie, thanks for coming on the show. Definitely, you know, Bad Science Watch is exactly the kind of organization we need out there pushing back against basically the manufacturer of a double standard to allow health fraud to be essentially promoted as legitimate by the government. And it's amazing that it's succeeding. 40 years ago, this would all have been, this would have been a health fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's government sanctioned.
Yep.
They won. They essentially won. Now we're trying to just do damage control.
Well, our aims are a little bit higher. We're trying to drive a fundamental change. We think it may take 10 to 15 years, but, you know, we're in it for the long run. We're under no illusions that it's going to be easy or quick, but we think it can be done.
Yeah, I agree, but it is a generational struggle. It's the kind of thing that's going to take decades, I think, to really turn this ship around. All right, Jamie. Well, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for fighting the good fight. Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much. You guys too.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Yep.
Si,
senor.
Okay. Here we go. Item number one. For the first time, scientists have created photonic molecules, coaxing photons of light to interact with each other to form a new state of matter. All right, number two, a recently published study of deep brain stimulation finds it effective for increasing empathy in subjects who rate highly on the psychopath scale. And item number three, astronomers have discovered a new type of pulsar that regularly switches between radio and X-ray emissions. All right, Evan, go first.
So I take it there's no theme.
Very perceptive.
Photonic molecules, coaxing photons of light to interact with each other to form a new state of matter. That's huge. Isn't that huge?
Think, right?
A new state of matter? How come that's not bigger news than it should be? Right? This is big. New state of matter. I just am stunned by this. The study about deep brain stimulation certainly seems, I don't see anything wrong. Improbable, implausible about this. I'm not quite sure. Deep brain stimulation versus other forms of stimulation. When they talk about deep, are they talking about actual physical depth into the brain itself?
Yes.
Or deep as far as the overall?
Physical depth.
Okay, physical depth. Moving on to the last one. The astronomers that have discovered a new type of pulsar regularly switches between radio and X-ray emissions. Oh, got to remember my scale now and figure out where radio's like a low energy. X-ray is up above, pretty high. That's a pretty big stretch as far as different kinds of emissions. And if it regularly switches between radio and X-ray emissions, does that mean it has to hit everything else kind of in between on the way during the course of that switching, or do you think it's some kind of simultaneous or instantaneous switch? If it's an instantaneous switch, I'm leaning towards this one being the fiction. I don't see how you can go from something so low energy like radio waves up to something very high like X-ray with a switch. So it would be probably maybe something more subtle. It's either that one or the photons and the new state of matter. Well, I'll do what I sometimes have to resort to. The most fantastic one, the one that can't be right, is going to turn out to be right. And therefore, this pulsar switching between the radio and X-rays, I think there's too much going on in between. And I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay. Jay?
The first one about the photonic molecules and them having it form a new state of matter. That I agree with Evan. Like, that's so huge. I mean, unless that came out today. But that being said, okay, let's think about what the thing is actually saying, that these photonic molecules, photons that are interacting with each other, and then they're forming a new state of matter. Wow. That's crazy. That is really crazy. Some type of, like, you know, ultra femtosecond or whatever. All right, I got to move on. So the second one about the deep brain stimulation increases empathy in psychopaths. And what's deep brain stimulation, Steve? Like electrodes? Like, what are they doing? Shocking these people?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. And they're saying that doing this to them is going to make them, all right, that's weird too. Okay. Now this last one here, pulsar switching between radio and X-ray emissions. I don't know. Evan, you pick that one. I think that one is out of the three of them, the easiest one to digest. Like, it's kind of, I could see something really cool happening where it switches between those two states. That being said, these other two. All right, I'm going to say that the deep brain stimulation one is the fake.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, I don't know anything about any of these three. So good job, Steve. No clue. So I'm going to play the psychological game here, and I'm going to say that the deep brain stimulation is the fake because there's a typo in that one, which means you did not copy and paste, which means you wrote it yourself. You filthy liar.
Huh. Okay, Bob.
Okay, photonic molecules. That is amazing. It's just too incredible. I really hope it's true. I do remember reading a while ago about theories about this, so it's not completely out of left field for me. But I really want this to be true. I mean, the classic argument is photons are massless and they don't interact. So how the hell are you going to make matter out of photons? So that's a classic argument against that. It just seems so bizarre. The second one, the deep brain stimulation, I just don't think we know enough about psychopaths to necessarily target specific areas and expect any kind of result like this. I mean, sure, it could have been done accidentally. That one's just rubbing me the wrong way. Third one, pulsars that switches between radio and X-ray. Yeah, that's pretty awesome too. If it's true, typically, you know, it's one or the other, or perhaps you could have a permanent progression from one to the other, but not arbitrarily switching back and forth. That's pretty awesome. I find it hard to think that a pulsar could do that just on its own. I think it may be interacting with another stellar body, another star in orbit, and somehow it's accreting matter, and somehow that's affecting the radiation it's giving off. I can kind of make sense of that. So I'm going to go with the psychopath one. That one just doesn't seem right. I don't think we could do that yet, and we know enough to do that.
All right. So you all agree that for the first time, scientists have created photonic molecules, coaxing photons of light to interact with each other to form a new state of matter.
Yeah.
You all think that one is science. That's very interesting.
Well, the least probable one.
And that one is science.
That's awesome.
A new state of matter.
Come on, seriously?
They discover new states of matter all the time. I'm serious. There are lots of states of matter, bizarre states of matter. This takes the cake, though. There's no question that this one takes the cake.
Yeah, when I read photonic molecules, I'm like, that's going in. That's definitely going in science fiction. So what they do is they used rubidium atoms in a vacuum chamber. And they cooled it down, so you have a super cooled cloud of rubidium atoms, almost just a few degrees above absolute zero. And then they send single photons through that cloud. Now what happens is that as the photons going through the cloud of atoms, because the cloud is so cold, the photons give up a lot of their energy to the atoms. So that massively slows down the photon. If they then send another photon through, what happens is the two photons come out together as if they're entangled with each other in some way. So they described it as, this is probably a gross oversimplification, but the two photons, because they have to stay out of each other's way while they're giving up the energy and slowing down. So they end up bumping into each other and then pushing and pulling each other through the cloud of supercooled atoms because they can't give up their energy in the same place at the same time because of some rule of physics. This is called the Rydberg blockade. So because of that effect, the Rydberg blockade.
Cool.
They end up interacting with each other and creating this photonic molecule.
I will admit I've read this, and you're right, Steve. You did a very good explanation of exactly what's going on.
Thank you.
I don't understand, what I don't understand though is that what's happening within the rubidium atom supercooled cloud is that the atoms in the cloud are mediating the interaction between the photons. So you need the atoms in there to mediate the interaction photon to photon. You need that. So what I don't understand is that when the photons exit, why they maintain this interaction, because the atoms are no longer there to mediate that interaction. So that's where they lost me on that. And I'm sure there's some technical answer, and I don't know how long this state exists, how long they stay paired. They were not clear about it. There were very few articles on this.
But Bob, what was not surprising was that they immediately made an analogy to
lightsabers. Of course.
Yeah, so
of course.
Yeah, so this development, of course, is going to lead immediately and directly to the development of lightsabers.
Yeah, and of course, one of the scientists actually used the used the lightsaber card. So of course, they had since the scientists mentioned it, they've got to go with it.
Lucan, one of the authors, said it's not an inapt analogy. There's that double negative again. To compare this to lightsabers. When these photons interact with each other, they're pushing against and deflect each other. The physics of what's happening in these molecules is similar to what we see in the movies.
What?
I like that sentence mainly because of the word inapt, which I don't think I've ever come across before. Yeah. Now, guys, I was reading this before we started recording, and I did mention it to you, but I want to get it on the podcast. I was reading it on Gizmodo I was reading the comments, which may no longer be there in the near future, but I'm glad they were there this time because I came across this comment by Valima750. He or she said, "This is going to end up being a science or fiction question on Skeptic's Guide to the Galaxy, I'm sure," which of course was incredibly hilarious for obvious reasons, not the least bit that they got the name wrong, but that's okay. And it's so funny that it was actually in science fiction. And I kind of suspected it would be because it was so awesome, such an awesome story. So it all came together so nicely.
All right, well, let's move on. Let's jump up to number three. Astronomers have discovered a new type of pulsar that regularly switches between radio and X-ray emissions. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science.
Oh,
and this one is science.
Woohoo!
Sorry, Evan. Good job, everyone.
That's pretty cool.
Haha.
Yeah, this one's pretty cool as well.
Back and forth. What the hell?
So, this is a new type of pulsar they discovered. And what do you think is causing this rapid switch? It is like flipping a switch. It's not just going up and down.
Does it have enough?
Well,
I guess
you don't dial it across.
I guess my idea
is affected by another star, celestial body,
another star in orbit, probably.
Yeah, it's got a companion star that occasionally dumps a huge amount of gas onto it, causing this intense X-ray burst. Yeah, so just it gets an extra layer of fuel gets added on top, and that fuel undergoes runaway thermonuclear reactions. And then you get the X-ray bursts, and then when it gets used up, then it goes back down to just putting out radio waves, but then the gas builds up, and then boom, you get another burst of X-ray.
Boom, huh?
So it just keeps going back and forth.
The noise it makes?
Yeah, not bam. Not bam, but boom.
I prefer bam.
Yeah, so it's a radio pulsar, and then it switches over to being an X-ray pulsar. Pretty cool. Which means that a recently published study of deep brain stimulation finds it finds it effective for increasing empathy in subjects who rate highly on the psychopath scale is fiction, despite the fact that technically I never cut and paste any of the science fiction items. I always construct the sentences by myself.
Beaten at your own game. The psychological game wins again.
It's just luck. That was just luck. Complete coincidence.
I don't believe in coincidences.
This is based upon a real study, however, looking at psychopaths. So, Bob, you're right, but maybe this study moves us a little bit farther towards understanding what's happening neurologically, the neuroanatomical correlation of psychopaths. They did look at the brain activation in people who – in controls versus psychopaths when they were asked to imagine other people's pain. Psychopaths, the parts of their brain that are supposed to light up. So when they imagine their own pain, then the appropriate parts of the brain light up. When they are asked to imagine other people's pain, nothing.
Oh, awesome.
But they have an atypical activation pattern that suggests that they might actually enjoy thinking about other people's
pain. Holy crap.
Ugh. That's much scarier than I suspected.
That's psychopaths, you know. Specifically, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex.
That's not at all what I previously understood about psychopaths, though. Yeah. Like, you know, obviously the stereotype is that they're mean, that they, you know, do terrible things to people. But in my understanding, that was only because they were doing these things in order to – because what they were doing would directly benefit themselves, and they didn't care about the consequences of other people's emotions. But thinking that they do care about other people's emotions and that they are out to cause negative emotions is much, much worse, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve, is psychopathy a word?
Sure.
Yes.
Cool.
Psychopathy, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So, Bob, maybe with these kinds of studies, we'll learn enough about their brains to stick some electrodes in there and maybe give them a more of a typical reaction to the notion of other people's pain.
Well, Steve, could transcranial magnetic stimulation pull that off without sticking electrodes in the brain?
Maybe. Yeah, I just made up the whole deep brain stimulation thing.
I knew it.
But deep brain stimulation is a thing. It's actually a really useful technology. We're using it to treat things like Parkinson's disease, for example. Very effective. You know, they stick electrodes deep in the brain using imaging to know exactly where to place the electrodes. And sometimes they got to make a little adjustments. Very effective technology. We're at the very beginning stages of directly hacking into the brain electrically. And this is a very important therapeutic technology. So it's not impossible that at some point in the future, you know, we'll be using DBS for lots of other things, maybe even more psychological effects, such as treating people who are criminal or psychopaths or whatever. All right, Jay, you got a quote for us?
This quote was sent in by Tom Kennedy from Sydney, Australia, and the quote is: "The grand aim of all science is to cover the greatest number of empirical facts by logical deduction from the smallest possible number of hypotheses or axioms." Dr. Einstein.
That's kind of a restatement of Occam's razor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Smallest possible number of hypotheses and axioms.
I would say so.
Are you throwing shade at Einstein?
No,
Steve, I think you are.
Perfectly cromulent quote.
Steve, I encourage our listeners to go to the SGU Reddit page. That's just /r/SGU. We have some fun discussions on there. I've been catching up lately and I'm having a good time.
Also, you should go to lightthenight.org. That's an event that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does as a big fundraiser. And this year, the skeptics are joining a bunch of other skeptics and free thought organizations to raise a ton of money. In fact, the Stiefel Free Thought Society, the Stiefel Free Thought Foundation has promised to match the first $250,000 we raise for LLS until December 31st. So if you go to lightthenight.org, you can search for Skeptic or you can search for my name and you can donate. There are certain things that we'll be doing if we can raise a certain amount of money. There are lots of fun stuff there, including if we skeptics raise a certain amount of money, Todd Stiefel himself will cut his hair into a mohawk, which will be fun. So please donate. You can even join our virtual team and help raise money for us yourself. It's a great cause.
Curing cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Or at least developing better treatments for blood cancer.
Yeah, let's go with the cure.
Okay. Shoot for the stars.
Right. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. And don't forget that this episode was brought to you by Hulu Plus. To sign up for your free trial of Hulu Plus and start watching your favorite shows right now, and for an extended free trial, go to HuluPlus.com/SGU, or just go to our homepage and there will be a link right there for you.